The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Invite him here. And the title that Dan suggested, which I took up, is What Went Wrong with the Cuban Revolution? And the very question is a very value-laden question, and certainly, ultimately, I would contend a class question. Because from whose point of view are you looking at what went wrong with the Cuban Revolution? Certainly from the traditional Stalinist and neo-Stalinist politics expressed in Maoism, Guevaraism, feudalism, and so on, there has been a smashing success. That is, that is, from that point of view, Cuba has survived the end of the Cold War plus many years afterwards. The great majority of the productive property in Cuba is nationalized. There is a one-party state. And that one-party state, the Cuban Communist Party, is still in full power. And even though it has given concessions to private capital, mostly foreign, and to Cuban self-employment, still 75% of the labor force is still work for the state. So from that point of view, there is no failure to talk about. Now, that point of view of nationalization equals socialism equals my support for the Cuban Revolution, as some would say, is quite frankly in decline. And what I find much more, far more common on the left, and I would say hegemonic on the left, is not that point of view, but the point of view that says, I don't support the Cuban regime because I think it's a socialist regime in whatever meaning of that, but I think it's a progressive regime, and it's progressive because it has a very generous welfare state, and it has maintained the national independence from U.S. imperialism, and therefore it's worth supporting. And I think the issue of the welfare state merits some closer examination, because most of these people talk as if it was 1990, and nothing has changed in Cuba since 1990 pertaining to the welfare state, and nothing could be further from the truth. So there's a big dividing line up to 1990, which is the collapse of the Soviet bloc, and the massive subsidies to the Cuban economy, which financed a fairly generous welfare state, and all the time that has gone on since then. And by the way, in a couple of years, as much time will have elapsed since the special period that's between the Cuban Revolution and the beginning of the special period. I mean, about 30 years on each side of the equation. So before 1990, there is an element of truth to that Cuba is progressive because of its welfare state characteristics. It is true that before 1990, the Cuban government, with massive Soviet subsidies, was able to maintain what I would call an austere standard of living, guaranteeing most basic needs, except, of course, for the chronic shortages of consumer goods, which were typical of Cuba as they were of the Eastern Soviet bloc. That is the same structural phenomenon reproduced itself in Cuba, so it was a continual rotating shortage of consumer goods and a permanent housing crisis. Also very similar to the Soviet bloc and not for accidental reasons. You know, it's a structural duplication of the characteristics of the economy and the problems that are produced by those characteristics of the economy. But nevertheless, there was that kind of basic guarantee for minimum living standards. Since 1990, however, there has been a serious deterioration of the welfare state for expressing a wide variety of fronts. Ever since that medicine became, and the export of doctors and nurses and so on to other countries, some like in the case of Venezuela, in exchange for oil, and in other countries, in exchange for hard currency payments. This has affected the Cuban health system. For example, the family doctor system that was established in the 1980s, which there was a doctor for each geographical area to attend to the immediate needs of families. That has deteriorated considerably. That is, the territory that a family doctor has to cover has expanded tremendously, and therefore much less able to respond to family needs. A crumbling of the educational and health infrastructure. For example, at the beginning of the school year that is about to end, 350 schools were closed in Cuba because they were a health and safety of the students and faculty and staff. So there is a crumbling infrastructure that goes along with the inability of the Cuban government to produce an economic surplus for reinvestment, not only in the productive apparatus, but reinvestment in the basic structure that is needed for functioning health and educational system. And this is one of the most severe crises that the Cuban government is facing now, which is to have enough of a surplus for at least to keep up to the facilities that already exist. Forget about creating new facilities, both in the productive apparatus as well as the social welfare field. I could give you many other examples of that. Pensions for all people in Cuba are a joke. That is, they are in pesos. They are essentially meaningless. And the regular salaries, 650 pesos is the median a month, is the median wage salary in Cuba. And of course, that is useful to pay your rent to the government for those people who are still paying rent for their houses, to pay taxes and to pay that because that's paid in pesos. And the shrinking ration budget, which also is paid in pesos. But that the government has been very clear that they eventually want to abolish the rational system, and in the meantime they have been progressively reduced. Anything beyond the rational system has to be paid in hard currency. And therefore the Cuban people have come to depend overwhelmingly on remittances, which are something nobody knows for sure, but the calculus is $2 to $3 billion a year in remittances that keep people afloat in Cuba and contributes to severe significant growth of inequality, particularly racial inequality, since nobody knows again for sure what proportion of the Cuban population is black, but let's say it's 50-50, just to make it simple. There's a disproportionate number of Cuban blacks who, for obvious reasons, have no relatives in the United States or Spain, by the way, it's not just the United States, and therefore receive no or very small remittances. Oil now, with the problems, the crisis in Venezuela has become also more scarce in Cuba, and it raises the question about which we might want to discuss about the viability of any kind of a welfare state that was built on the basis of Soviet subsidies. So, therefore, when people talk about Cuban welfare state, they are, even publications that should know better, like The Nation, and so on, write as if everything was the same and nothing has changed in Cuba from 1999. But let's assume that we're still living in the late 80s and there's still this fairly generous welfare state in spite of its serious shortcomings. Would the revolution have gone wrong? If this discussion was being held in 1989, and the welfare state more or less, in spite of its shortcomings, function, would have revolution have gone wrong? And there again, your political position and political values are critical in this. Because if we, and people in this room, in a conference sponsored by Historical Materialism, I can assume that most people here are considered themselves socialists. If we are socialists, what does it mean to be socialist in Cuba, here, or anywhere else, if the democracy and the necessary freedoms to make democracy possible, like access, not just majority vote, but that is strength, of course, but access to the mass media, for example, are absent? And I would say that, as I try to develop in the rest of my talk today, that on those grounds, I think that in 1989, and I will try to defend this position, I would also have said that it had gone wrong, not just because of what happened since 1989. Essentially, what started out as a democratic multi-class, and I want to emphasize that, multi-class revolution, I think could have evolved into a socialist democracy with a lot of problems and difficulties that we may want to discuss here if you are so inclined. And therefore, things went wrong, in my opinion, very early on, I would say 1960, 1961, when any form of socialist democracy was discarded, eliminating the liberatory and emancipatory politics of the 1959 revolution. Now, a typical left reaction to that is, well, that was the because of the United States imperialism. And therefore, what happened in Cuba was purely a reaction to U.S. imperialism. A classic formulation of that is Cuba Tragedy in Our Hemisphere by Zeitlin and Scheer back in 1963, when that book appeared, where pretending to be liberals, they because I think it was a very dishonest book as well, they put forward the thesis that exactly that's what happened. That is, that Cuba was in danger of going capital to communist because of United States policy. As if they had been, as if an alternative U.S. policy would have been possible. And what they did. After all, the U.S. behaved in Cuba no different than it behaved in relation to Guatemala or any of the other revolutions and reforms that happened in Latin America. But I think, in my opinion, this notion that the choice of the what I would call the Stalinist rule in Cuba, of the one-party state, was certainly, as Che Guevara himself put it, and if Che Guevara had equality, it was straightforwardness and a kind of political honesty. But in an interview that he gave to the Express, the French weekly, in 1963, he said that the choice of our political choice was half, as he put it, half the result of constraint and half the result of choice. Because as I explore in my book on Che, there were strong political currents in Cuba who favored that outcome. Long before the United States began its blockade, and long before the United States began to put tremendous hostile pressure after the agrarian reform law of May 1959. And for again, and I'm willing to adopt Che's formula, half the result of choice and half of constraint, what they proceeded to do was to build an overwhelmingly nationalized economy. In the 1980s, by the way, the Cuban economy was more nationalized than that of the Soviet Union. Well over 90% of productive property was nationalized in Cuba right before the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And created a one-party state, and a one-party state where no factions are allowed under the so-called, quote-unquote, democratic centralism. We all know it's all centralism and no democracy. And expressing itself and through the transmission belts, because people say, well, we don't need too many parties and so on, as if it was just a question of parties, and what it's ignoring that liberal objection to saying, you know, you're too fanatically adhere to multiplicity of parties, is that a one party state is not just the existence of one party, it's that party having a variety of transmission belts in the unions, the organization of women, in the fact that according to the law of associations in Cuba, there is a law of associations in Cuba, which has been put in the freezer, but it still isn't what exists. The law of associations said if you want to establish a voluntary association in Cuba, you have to attach yourself to some of state organization to which your interests correspond. You know, such as the Union Federation, for example, in the case of unions. Now, it is true that the government, in its current liberalization, has sort of pretended not to look when people have established various voluntary associations that are not contestatory. very critical of the SAN. These are non-contestatory voluntary associations, but they are neither attached to an organ of the state. So there's a certain degree of liberalization in Cuba. So it's a transmission belt through the union, through the organization of women that impede the independent action of people. The internet in Cuba is still way behind all the Latin America. It's growing gradually, but there is censorship of foreign sites. But in any case, it's still the least developed in the whole of the Caribbean, or one of the least developed in the whole of the Caribbean and Latin American base. State security is very systematic about repressing any organized active dissent, even as overwhelmingly it is peaceful, even of the most right-wing groups. Popular power, the so-called popular power in Cuba, which is a pretense of elections, so the National People's Power Assembly, essentially the elections where there's a choice is only at the lowest level, and people, candidates, there's more than one at the lowest level, are forbidden from campaigning on any substantive issue. Essentially, what you do is you put yourself as a candidate and you say, you give your biography. You know, my name is Jose Perez, and I fought in Angola, and since then I've been active in this and that political position in the government, and therefore I put myself forward. That's it. You cannot even compete with other candidates. Well, we have a problem with the traffic congestion in this town, just to give a very mild, non-contestatory thing, and I propose the following solution, and the other candidate proposes a different solution, and we're going to test it out in the election. Nothing like that. So by definition, there's no programmatic alternative that is offered. And of course, it is the Council of State, which is the executive Cuba, that legislates through decrees, and that National Assembly of People's Power meets for very few days each year, and it's essentially, it's an echo chamber for what the Council of State decides. Now, so by way of conclusion, and therefore to maximize the time that Elliot has and we have for discussion, I would say again that there is relatively speaking, little support left for the Cuban system as such, that is, as the model of socialism. But there is widespread, hegemonic, from my point of view, suffocating, and it is suffocating, view that it is that the Cuban system is progressive and therefore one should support it, not because it's a socialist model or anything like that. And it is, again, on an ignorant basis of a welfare state that no longer exists as people imagine that it did, and on anti-imperialist grounds. And in terms of anti-imperialist grounds, I would venture to say that today, the one unambiguous achievement of the Cuban government is the fact it's still a sovereign state. And in order to recognize that and support that, as I do, one doesn't have to support the social and economic and political system that exists in Cuba. That is, it is sufficient, as I do and all of us here do, is to oppose any attempt of U.S. imperialism to intervene in Cuban affairs. Most of the left has no problem, as far as I know, saying that the United States should not bomb Iran without, I don't hear too many people saying, well, how progressive the Iranian system is. I don't, maybe there are some people who think that, who knows? I mean, there are so many weird groups out there that, you know, everything is possible. But, you know, as a massive kind of attitude, by and large, that is not the case, you know. Well, I propose the same thing for Cuba. There should be unambiguous opposition to any kind of interference, economic, political, or otherwise, by the United States imperialism in Cuba, without that translating, in some sense, for critical or uncritical support of the Cuban system. Now, I think, and this is one of the two last things I'm going to say, I think that implicitly, sometimes more explicitly, sometimes less explicitly, but there is in this left ambience of progressive support because it's progressive, there is an implicit notion of a trade-off. It's a very common of a trade-off. The trade-off being, well, it is true, you know, that there is no political democracy or civil liberties in Cuba, but on the other hand, it's a national sovereignty, the supposed greatness of the welfare state, and therefore it is a trade-off that is worth having. Well, there are two things I'm going to say about that before ending. One of the things is that it's a trade-off that these people are willing to accept that they would not accept for their own society. That is, nobody, and very few people on the left, this progressive left, would accept the notion that in order to get, say, Bernie Sanders' program, for example, we get rid of all civil liberties and all rights to organize independently in Cuba. Nobody in their right mind, or very few people that are worth talking about, would admit that for the United States. Somehow it's okay for a country like Cuba in the so-called third world. With the assumption being, I think it's, and quite honestly, it's a vicious assumption, which is that people in Cuba don't care about handling their own affairs. That it's only the rich democracies, the democracy in the rich countries, where people care about that. Well, as a matter of fact, I myself and thousands of other people in Cuba were a product of the democracy movement against Batista in the 1950s when I was an activist in high school. You know, that's a long time ago. I'm sort of fessing up to my age. But so there was a democracy movement in Cuba, and have been democracy movements in many Latin American countries with a variety of possibilities opening up for further radicalization, to be sure. So people in the advanced countries who support the Cuban government, including Melenchon, for example, and I hope he wins, by the way. I really hope he wins, but let's face it, you know, it's a very widespread attitude among the left. The Linke in Germany are also big supporters of the Cuban government. It's a very widespread attitude. What they would not tolerate for themselves, they're willing to other people put up with it. And I would say that there is a problem. It's not that I am on principle against any notion of trade-off. The question is, what is the nature of the trade-off? And I think to agree to give up the organizational independence of the working class and the allies of the working class in exchange for anything is inadmissible. That there are all sorts of things that the left should be able and willing to support as transitional measures, but never giving up on organizational independence. And not only giving up on organizational independence, but also on the conditions that allow that organizational independence to have some meaning. Meaning free access to the media. Because the media in Cuba, that is the newspapers, the television, is completely monolithic on one point of view. And they don't hide it. You know, there's something called the ideological department of the Cuban Communist Party, led by a man called Rolando Alfonso Borges, that give orientations to the media. And curiously, an event happens, it takes a day or two before they publish it, because they have to decide on a line to how to deal with the issue. So some event may happen in the Middle East, all of a sudden it takes a day or two before they publish it, and because they have to discuss not just the event, but what is the attitude they're going to have. So on that line, I think that my answer is that things went wrong very early, and we should make sure that this government doesn't make life harder for the Cuban people to decide what they want to do. Thank you very much.
I'm going to sit down because I can't stand that long. But thanks, Eli, and thanks, Sam. And shout out to Dan Lobato. I know that he was sort of the brains behind the operation, pulling together this panel, but couldn't be here today. So my name's Elliot. I wrote this short book with PM that came out last year, Maoism and the Chinese Revolution, a critical introduction. Here, pass this around. I got a couple copies because I'm like a traveling shoe salesman. Lots of books. What I'm going to do today, this came out, you know, last summer, and then I've done some book tour dates and stuff, talking with people about it, and had many good conversations and some written engagements on different topics. One of the focuses, one of the topics of discussion that's come out is the question of state capitalism. How do you understand the political and economic system that developed in China under Mao after 1949 until really, you know, 1970s, and a different sort of transition happens? What's the nature of that system? So what I want to do, if I can squeeze it, usually when I do fucking book tour dates, it's like 2 hours plus talk with a slideshow and stuff. So I want to give like Cliff Notes version of the argument in the book and try to zoom in a little bit on that nitty gritty state capitalism question. Because that's the thing I've been thinking a bit about in the past few months. So the perspective I put out in this book, my reading at least, is the book's actually an attempt to give some sort of critical account of Maoist politics. What's the nature of the strategy, tactics, work methods, philosophy that develops over the course of the Chinese Revolution, writ large, like 27 to kind of the zenith of the Cultural Revolution, pretty big time span. What are those foundational concepts that arise in that process that get synthesized as Mao Zedong thought and Maoism later? And after situating them in that historical process that produces them, what are the strengths, weaknesses, internal blind spots, contradictions, whatever, of those politics? The sense that I came to in my study of that history and politics is I read Maoism as a kind of internal critique of the Stalinist tradition that fails to fundamentally break out of the box and break out of those categories. Sometimes I use an allegory. C.L.R. James' Notes on Dialectics, right? He's critiquing Trotsky, and he's like, Trotsky just did synthetic cognition. You know, he didn't do like dialectical reason. He did synthetic cognition, and his categories held him by the throat till the very end. You know, and I think we could make a similar claim about how Mao, and not just Mao, but his allies and the party, developed their politics over the course of their revolutionary struggle, and then from a position of state power. I think in place of the politics are a critique of received Stalinist categories, definitely, but they aren't necessarily a Marxist imminent critique. They aren't taking up the categories, you look at them, you see their blind spots, you see their contradictions when you play them out, right? You don't then situate those categories in the political context, the contradictory social context that created those categories, which rendered them contradictory, which then allows you to negate those categories and move forward to something else. The types of critique and of anything from the notion of transition to the, you know, what's the nature of the character of socialism is, it's like tweaking. You bend and adapt the terms in which a debate is given to you. Mao was writing notes in 1950s on Stalin's text on political economy, and he's writing marginal notes, and Stalin is saying, which needs to be bigger, big industry or small industry? And he says, well, I think actually it should be a little bit more of a balance. You have some sort of opposition between terms, and you're tweaking the opposition between the terms. Maybe you're layering on top a set of ancillary concepts, but you aren't necessarily negating those categories, explaining why their oppositions are posed as such to develop something new. So I think what happens is that type of critique and those type of concepts develop over the course of really from 27 on until the zenith of the Cultural Revolution. When put into practice, you wind up with a set of strategies, practices, and work methods that are as contradictory in practice as the concepts are. Those concepts inherit many of the same foundational assumptions from the kind of Stalinist orthodoxy, and the same blind spots and ambiguities that obscure the contradictions in those concepts. And when put into practice, they wind up producing a contradictory practice. It kind of vacillates back and forth, and in many cases winds up eroding the autonomy and initiative of the working class, the class in whose names the politics are speaking, and leaves whoever's implementing them kind of a bureaucratic interest group among others with a kind of demobilized base, and leaves room for the right to come in. I think the way that development happens is grounded in and reflects the class position of Mao and his allies in the party. And without cleaving too much to the term, I think the term state capitalism is a useful one. It explains, it doesn't obscure, it gives us some idea to understand what's put in place after 49. And it flags both the continuity, what I would see as a fundamental continuity between the fundamental relationships of the Chinese economy and society after 49 with other forms of capitalism, and also the things that make it very different. But, okay. I'll touch on a couple, dig into this a little bit more. First, where the building blocks of Maoist politics come from. I'm assuming people have some, you know, sense of the history and the timeline. I'd say from, you know, 1927 to 49, all the way from the, you know, disaster where the Communist Party backs Chiang Kai-shek and he turns around and kills a bunch of them in the street, and they have to pivot to the countryside, then they have to flee, they have to do the whole long march up to Yunnan. That process is an organizational break with the Comintern and the Soviet Union. I mean, literally, in some cases, they lose radio contact at a certain point. Organizationally, there's a shakeup, right? The Mao and others come to leadership in the party. Motherfuckers who've been trained in Moscow are asked out, you know? And then you get up to Yunnan, and then finally you have a little bit of breathing room. War breaks out with Japan. The leadership of the Chinese Communist Party can come up with its own ideas. What is transition going to look like in our context? What is the strategy to see that transition through, including what's the military strategy? And also, what do we mean by Marxism, communism, socialism, historical materialism, the dialectic? And a whole set of new concepts get developed and synthesized in the 1930s. But I'd say in most of those cases, some of Mao's the most famous works, right, get developed in the maybe late 1930s. You have On Practice, On Contradiction get written. Some earlier texts on guerrilla warfare get synthesized in Yunnan. Many of those texts and many of those concepts, I'd say, draw on the orthodoxy that they're getting from the Soviet Union, which has only recently been synthesized. So, for example, in the 1930s, Mao and other leaders are doing a study on dialectics. They've been getting critiqued by some of the leadership that was educated in Moscow. You don't really understand the science of Marxism-Leninism. So they do an extensive study group, and they're reading a range of different texts. But partly what they're reading is the orthodoxy that's already been established by the mid-1930s, when the conflict within the Soviet Academy of Sciences and philosophy and whatnot has been dampened down, and there's a state orthodoxy that's put in place, a dialectical materialism, the sort of Diamat orthodoxy that then gets written into a series of popular manuals. There's a manual, a course on dialectical materialism, one popular manual. Mao gives 13,000 characters of notation to it. The basic study notes that he puts together and then circulates through the party is kind of a political education text. It's kind of the basis for what becomes On Practice and On Contradiction, are in part composed of verbatim quotes from the text. So in the back door come a lot of the foundational assumptions that have already been solidified just a few years prior in the Soviet Union. You have the notion, a kind of reflective notion of consciousness. Contradictions that we experience in our consciousness are more or less a Xerox of what exists in the objective world. You have the notion that dialectics operates in almost like a law of physics in the outside world. Historical materialism is the science that allows you to understand how that process must go. I'd say there's similar don't have time to touch on it now, but a similar process occurs with the notion of transition and the concept of the United Front. And then, crucially, I think the party's understanding of the content of socialism also remains. The understanding is the party's going to take power. Maybe it'll be through a new democratic revolution that'll peacefully transition to socialism, right? But regardless, the working class, through its representative, the Communist Party, will take power and move towards socialism by nationalizing the large sectors of the economy. And that's basically what happens. So I'd argue this is like 1930s, right? Late 1930s. Up through 1949, these are the set of the concepts they have when they march into Beijing October 1949 and declare the founding of the People's Republic. By 1956, that's like the big year in which the majority of large firms are nationalized and the majority of land is collectivized. And they've achieved it in a more rapidly and in a less bloody fashion than collectivization was achieved in the Soviet Union. By 56, I think that's about the transition point when most of the leadership of the Communist Party figures, we've made it and we've transitioned into something that can be understood as socialism. I'm curious to get a sense of what everybody else thinks, and we'll probably have some time to discuss it. From my perspective, what's established is a different form of capitalism with very similar sets of fundamental relationships. You have a rate wage relation, you have generalized commodity production, you have the state directing capital accumulation and directing the sort of trajectory of society's reproduction by managing the surplus that it creates and its patterns of reinvestment and capital formation. I think value matters very differently in that context, and it's the forms that it takes are what the Alfabian Collective calls deformations of value. I mean, it's deformations in the sense that Western free market capitalism is the normative model. Mm-hmm. But okay, value matters, but it matters differently, would be my argument. I think you have a form of what we could think of as like a formal subsumption of the labor process in the city, a real subsumption of the labor process in the cities, and a formal subsumption in the countryside, and that difference is formalized by the system. Mm-hmm. In the city, you have people going to work and working for wages and buying the shit that they need with those money wages to reproduce themselves. In the countryside, you have peasants working for work points that gives them a cut of their profits at the end of the season, right? Minus the value of whatever they've eaten in the meantime, paid in a mix of in-kind wages, again, tracked in money terms or sometimes money wages, and the in-kind wages they can turn around and sell on local markets. And then you have the state as a whole kind of managing this crazy. Yeah, it's a very complex system and extremely difficult to manage. The thing I've been geeking out on for the last some months, it's amazing what you find interesting, is like translations of like planners' manuals from the mid-50s. As they're trying to figure out how you plan this fucking system. And I read a great dissertation about developing the statistical system for tracking this economy. Right? But I mean, obviously it's a huge and gargantuan task to figure out how you plan a country and an economy of this size. And the more it grows, the more lines of production open up, the more complex interconnections there are. I mean, it's really crazy. I mean, interestingly, they're grappling with both the Soviets and the Chinese are grappling with how to do that kind of planning. And there's a guy in the West, I can't remember the guy's name, who wins. Can anybody help me out here? He comes out with how to do
it. Leontief.
The
input-output system a few years later wins. What does he win? Nobel? For doing it. Thank you. So they're all grappling with how to handle this at the same time. Real subsumption in urban areas, formal subsumption in the countryside. So I would say briefly, I just say this is a society in which the value form extends across the whole of society and which depends upon for its reproduction and also reinforces a strong centralized state, which is the only thing that can hold the motherfucker together, can allow those relations to reproduce themselves, but which itself comes with certain internal limits, and we can get to that in a little bit. there's a quote, I've been reading these manuals, right? There's a quote, I think it's 53 or 54, a series of articles for state planners. Some are very nitty-gritty, how you're going to do industrial balancing, how you're going to handle wage tables. Some are very broad, what's the point of socialist planning? Some quotes. One instructs young planners, the basic difference between socialism and capitalism lies in the fact that the socialist society can develop the national economy according to objective proportions in a conscious and planned way. Whereas under capitalism, real wages decline continuously due to increasing exploitation, under socialism, the wages of workers and staff increase continuously with the uninterrupted growth of production and labor productivity. I'd argue the vision that's being developed here sort of organically based on the economy that they're trying to figure out how to manage is one in which you try to find the sweet spot where capital accumulation can proceed sort of smoothly and you can get a bigger pie, you know, the slices of the pie can increase. They run into serious limits trying to do that and it happens fairly quickly. I'm willing right now to take as a working hypothesis, has anybody read the Marxian concept of capital and the Soviet experience? I don't know the dude's name.
Chattopadhyay
is how you pronounce it. That through a sort of interesting kind of idiosyncratic reading of some different volume, the different translations of different volumes of Capital, he develops a reading of the Soviet economy as state capitalist and also makes some claims about what kinds of internal limits it hits. And he characterizes the limit that the Soviet economy hits around the mid-1960s as a, as an absolute overaccumulation of capital. So he's claiming that there's kind of subsumption that occurs, and he even interprets collectivization as sort of a first phase of real subsumption in the sense that you centralize production and achieve a one-time leap in productivity. And then he says that you achieve a leap in productivity and transform the productive system, but then after that point, you don't endogenously achieve leaps in productivity. You can only achieve a given level of technique. And then you're basically, your rate of growth is dependent on absolute inputs of either labor or natural resources. And he says, well, the Soviet Union runs into that a ways down the road. It's very big, and also they have certain relationships, exploitative relationships after the war with the rest of the Soviet bloc, resources and access that China doesn't have. So they begin to hit their limits around the late 1950s. And I'm willing to take that as a working hypothesis about what happens and why. So what happens when you have that set of politics and let's just run with it for the time being, that set of politics and that kind of state capitalist economy in place. And let's say you begin to hit some limits, they start to fail in their productive targets by 7%, 10%, whatever, by 57, 58. The first indication of what happens is right around the 100 flowers period in the Great Leap Forward. So briefly, let's just take that as an example. Right? The Cultural Revolution is the bigger one, but I think you can get some interesting glimpses into the kind of political tendencies that arise in 100 Flowers period. So remember, this is in a global context, it's the beginning of de-Stalinization, the very, very, very beginning. Stalin croaks 53, Khrushchev's secret speech February 56. Shit's actually not that great in the Soviet Union. The all sorts of ramifications and reverberations across the global communist movement. So Khrushchev gives his speech February 56. May 56, Mao gives the 100 Flowers speech, which isn't publicly published. But interestingly, in the really to his credit, he says, yes, there's major issues and contradictions within socialist society. We want to avoid the problems that we've seen developing in the Soviet Union. They had a fucking cool relationship with the Soviet Union and Stalin since jump. You know? They want to figure out what's a different way of doing things. And he's saying, let 100 flowers bloom, 100 schools of thought contend. It's very daring, actually. He believes we can solve these contradictions. These contradictions are non-antagonistic under socialism and can be solved using the method of criticism and self-criticism. We're going to do like a party rectification, but through all of society. It's really daring. He says that in May 56. In November of that year, the sort of shock, initial shock waves of de-Stalinization start to flicker outward. So you have the Polish party wants to be independent. And initially, the Chinese party backs them. Sorry, independent from the Soviet Union. The Chinese party backs them and says, yeah, we're also against big nation chauvinism. You know, we don't want to be pushed around by the Communist Party and the Soviet Union either. So we back Poland, you know, let them do their thing. A few days later, the Hungarian revolt breaks out. This goes beyond the issue of party independence to you get workers' councils in Hungary, and then the Khrushchev sends in the tanks and crushes them. And at that point, Mao and the Chinese party flips and they back the tanks. They say, yes, you're right, if things get too out of hand, then they need to be contained militarily. That's November, December 56. By the end of the year, in the beginning of 57, the 100 Flowers campaign of like public critique and a mass rectification campaign is starting rolling. It's already happening. And the party is having all kinds of internal debates about like how far are we going to go with this thing? What are going to be the limits of it, right? We've seen the span of possible outcomes. We just watched it happen in Eastern Europe. So how are we going to play this in our own context? February 57, Mao gives the On Correct Handling of Contradictions Among the People speech, very famous speech, right, in which he names different kinds of contradictions that exist in Chinese society, the contradiction between the party and the people, the contradiction between big industry and small industry, between the urban and the rural. Right? He's identifying all the kind of the areas of contention and flashpoints that are emerging as the Chinese economy and society develop. But they don't publish it immediately because, again, these debates are rolling about about the scope of debate and discussion in the 100 Flowers period. By spring 1957, the 100 Flowers campaign is moving even a little bit bigger and faster than the party leadership had expected. So you have a lot of sort of popular protest repertoires that kind of prefigure what will eventually happen on an even bigger scale and more context in the Cultural Revolution like a decade later. But you have big poster campaigns in the universities and public debates about the nature of socialist society and students and intellectuals speaking in public on these issues. Of course you got some members of the former elite and some intellectuals that are like, fuck this shit, give me multi-party democracy and some, you know, free market society, I want out. At the same time, you have what almost prefigures what will become the ultra-left in the Cultural Revolution, the most famous of whom is a student leader named Lin Shi Ling, you lose track of her after a little time. I don't know if she disappears, but the documentation that I've seen is articles about her that are written in the newspapers. And she's speaking to, she becomes sort of a student celebrity in the public meetings. She's sort of famed, but is critiqued in the papers for saying, like, I've been reading Marx and Engels, and like I don't think socialism in one country is possible. And I don't think that we're in socialism, actually. And so I want to move forward to real socialism. And in fact, I think, you know, the various privileges of the bureaucratic elite means, you know, so something pretty bad. So we need to move further. The upsurge isn't just limited to public debate in the universities, although that's a big section. It's also the first major strike wave. That's the large strike wave after 1949. In Shanghai alone, you have around 30,000 workers participate in labor actions in almost about 590 enterprises. It's also in other parts of the country. What's happening? The workers are going to get the boss, beating him up a little bit, put the fucking placard on him, haul him out, dump him in the river, march down to the trade union office. The trade union is like left in the dust and is delegitimized and has to rush to catch up and legitimate what they're doing. Workers are demanding everything from a return to the traditional bonuses, which were gotten rid of in the wage rationalizations of 55-56, and also in some cases a return to kind of the ad hoc control they had over the workplaces in around 1949. You know, year or two before, year or two after, things were pretty shaky. In some cases, bosses ran away, workers had some flex room, more so than what gets put in place by the mid-1950s. You know, so the pot's boiling. It isn't boiled over, but it's at a steady boil. And so the debates within the party about the scope of the critique in the 100 Flowers campaign start to kind of come to a head. In this spring 57, in June, a final version of Mao's On the Contradictions Among the People speech is published, but with little addendums. You can see the original versions, and you can see the final published version. The final published version includes some tweaks, the contradictions among the people that the document lists, between party and the people, between big industry and small industry, are non-antagonistic under socialism. But they can become antagonistic if they are influenced by outside forces or members of the overthrown classes. And therefore, we have to be careful that they don't boil over and become antagonistic and threaten the very sort of integrity of our society. And therefore, certain limits need to be put in place. The public criticisms need to strengthen, not weaken, the leadership of the Communist Party. They need to not disrupt production. In other words, the actual contradictions in society have produced a kind of social rupture. It's not huge yet, but it's there. It's significant. It indicates what could happen further. The party leadership, well, at the same time wanting to sort of call forth popular movements to de-bureaucratize the state and beat back the bad tendencies that they see in the Soviet system and in their own, at the same time, those same tendencies are dangerous because they threaten the fundamental relationships on which society is based and reproduced, and on whose power the party depends in order to maintain its social position. And therefore, you're stuck in this, back and forth. So by mid-late 57, the shift is made, a very sharp shift from the 100 Flowers campaign to an anti-rightist campaign. And a lot of the critics that have arisen to critique the party and sort of issues in Chinese society in general get beaten back, both from the left and the right forces. About five.
Excuse me.
Critiqued on both sides.
Sorry, everybody.
Come in. A point I make here is this is a moment. Let's scooch over. This is a moment when you can see the politics and discourse of the Chinese Communist Party become more and more ideological. That's a point I try to make, right? Because what happens in the anti-rightist crackdown? They crack down on both the members of the, you know, overthrown classes who are like, give me back my small business, and the student radicals that want to move forward into what they think are real socialism. Both of those things become rightist by 1958. The very terms, left, right, revolutionary, counter-revolutionary, are kind of drained of their content. Less and less do they refer to actual class interests in a given conjuncture. Right? More and more do they refer to loyalty or disloyalty to the party at a given moment. So, but yet at the same time, those are the terms of state and the terms in which any claim on the state from, you know, the, you know, wanting some kind of political representation and your interests to be taken into account, to wanting a goddamn promotion so that you can, you know, become a member of the party and get to the city instead of being in the countryside. All those claims have to be made in terms of that discourse, much like rights discourse in a Western society. So you see the terms, the very terms themselves are rendered contradictory, and those terms split apart a decade later from the inside out in the Cultural Revolution, when groups and factions actually battle over the meaning of what it is to be revolutionary, what socialism is, the content. And those contradictions come to the fore later. Yeah, like a third of the book is the Cultural Revolution, which is even more like fireworks and, you know, action. But I hope that maybe here we can have a little time to discuss. But that's the general contention. Something that we can think of as a form of capitalism with a different way in which the value form is reproduced. There's some deformations in value, but which influence the development of Maoist politics and the problems with which they have to grapple and the things which have to remain unquestioned in those politics, which are largely the same blind spots that they've inherited from the Soviet Union, even though they're attempting to critique and come up with their own way of doing things, and which lead down kind of similar to similar disasters and dangers. Word.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.